can paralyze them. Studies show that when faced with 24 varieties of jam in a grocery store, for example, or lots of investment options for their pension plan, people often choose arbitrarily or walk away without making any choice at all, rather than labor to make a reasoned choice. I certainly felt happier choosing between two pairs of black pants that I liked rather than among five pairs of black pants, the majority of which were either uncomfortable or unfashionable, and which made me feel guilty for never wearing them, to boot. Who knew that doing something so mundane could give me such a kick? By this point, I was jonesing for more of the clutter-clearing buzz, so while a pregnant friend opened her presents at a baby shower, I quizzed my fellow guests for new strategies. "Focus on the dump zones," advised one friend. "You know, the dining room table, the kitchen counter, the place where everyone dumps their stuff." "Right," I said. "Our biggest dump zone is a chair in our bedroom. We never sit in it. We just pile clothes and magazines on it." Junk attracts more junk. If you clear it off, it's likely to stay clear. "And here's another thing," she continued. "When you buy any kind of device, put the cords, the manual, all that stuff in a labeled Ziploc bag. You avoid having a big tangle of mystery cords. Plus, when you get rid of the device, you can get rid of the ancillary parts, too." "Try a virtual move," another friend added. "I just did it myself. Walk around your apartment and ask yourself, if I were moving, would I pack this or get rid of it?" "I never keep anything for sentimental reasons alone," someone else claimed. "Only if I'm still using it." These suggestions were helpful, but that last rule was too draconian for me. I'd never get rid of the "Justice Never Rests" t-shirt from the aerobics class I took with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor when I clerked for her, even though it never did fit, or the doll-sized outfit that our preemie Eliza wore when she came home from the hospital. At least these items didn't take up much room. I have a friend who keeps 12 tennis rackets, left over from her days playing college tennis. When one of my college roommates visited New York, we waxed lyrical over coffee about the glories of clutter clearing. "What in life," I demanded, "gives immediate gratification equal to cleaning out a medicine cabinet? Nothing." "No, nothing," she agreed with equal fervor, but she took it even further. "You know, I keep an empty shelf." "What do you mean?" "I keep one shelf somewhere in my house, completely empty. I'll pack every other shelf to the top, but I keep one shelf bare." I was struck by the poetry of this resolution. An empty shelf. And she had three children. An empty shelf meant possibility, space to expand, a luxurious waste of something useful for the sheer elegance of it. I had to have one. I went home, went straight to my hall closet, and emptied a shelf. It wasn't a big shelf, but it was empty. Thrilling. I hunted through the apartment, and no object, no matter how small, escaped my scrutiny. I'd long been annoyed by the maddening accumulation of gimcracks that children attract. Glittery Super Balls, miniature flashlights, small plastic zoo animals, this stuff was everywhere. It was fun to have, and the girls wanted to keep it, but it was hard to put it away, because where did it go? My eighth commandment is identify the problem. I'd realized that often I put up with a problem for years because I never examined the nature of the problem and how it might be solved. It turns out that stating a problem clearly often suggests its solution. For instance, I hated hanging up my coat, so I usually left it slung on the back of a chair. Identify the problem. Why don't I ever hang up my coat? Answer: I don't like fussing with hangers. Solution: so use the hook on the inside of the door. When I asked myself, what's the problem with all these little toys? I answered, Eliza and Eleanor want to keep this stuff, but we don't have a place to put it away. Bingo. I immediately saw the solution to my problem. The next day, I stopped by the container store and bought 5 large glass canisters. I combed the apartment to collect toy flotsam and stuffed it in. Clutter cured. I filled all 5 jars. What I hadn't anticipated was that the jars looked great on the shelf. Colorful, festive, and inviting. My solution was ornamental, as well as practical. A pleasant, unintended consequence of my clutter clearing was that it solved the 4 thermometer syndrome. I could never find our thermometer, so I kept buying new ones. And when my clutter clearing flushed them all out, we had four thermometers, which I never used, by the way. I felt the back of the girls' necks to see if they had a fever. It's a secret of adulthood. If you can't find something, clean up. I discovered that although it seemed easier to put things away in general areas, the coat closet, any kitchen drawer, it was more satisfying when each item went in a highly specific location. One of life's small pleasures is to return something to its proper place. Putting the shoe polish on the second shelf in the linen closet gave me the archer's satisfaction of hitting a mark. I also hit on a few daily rules to help keep the apartment from constantly falling into disorder. First, following my fourth commandment, do it now, I started to apply the one-minute rule. I didn't postpone any task that could be done in less than 1 minute. I put away my umbrella, I filed a document, I put the newspapers in the recycling bin, I closed the cabinet door. These steps took just a few moments, but the cumulative impact was impressive. Along with the one-minute rule, I observed the evening tidy-up by taking 10 minutes before bed to do simple tidying. Tidying up at night made our mornings more serene and pleasant, and, in an added benefit, helped prepare me for sleep. Putting things in order is very calming, and doing something physical makes me aware of being tired. If I've been reading under the covers for an hour before turning out the light, I don't get the same feeling of luxurious comfort when I stretch out in bed. As the clutter behind closed doors and cabinets began to diminish, I attacked visual clutter. For instance, we subscribed to a huge number of magazines, and we couldn't keep them neat. I cleared out a drawer, and now we keep our magazines stacked out of sight, ready to grab before we head to the gym. I'd been keeping invitations, school notices, and various miscellany posted on a bulletin board, but I pulled it all down and moved it into a file labeled Upcoming Events and Invitations. I was no more or less organized than before, but our visual chaos dropped. I dreaded doing the clutter clearing because it seemed like such an enormous job, and it was an enormous job. But every time I looked around and saw the extra space and order, I registered a little jolt of energy. I was thrilled with the improved conditions in our apartment, and I kept waiting for Jamie to say, "Boy, everything looks terrific. You've done so much work. It's so much nicer." But he never did. I love my gold stars, so that was disappointing. But on the other hand, he didn't complain about lugging 500 pounds of stuff to the thrift store. And even if he didn't appreciate my efforts as much as I'd expected, it didn't really matter. I felt uplifted and restored by my clutter clearing. Tackle a nagging task. Unfinished tasks were draining my energy and making me feel guilty. I felt like a bad friend because I hadn't bought a wedding gift. I felt like an irresponsible family member because I'd never gotten a skin cancer check, and I have the super fair skin that comes with red hair. I felt like a bad parent because our toddler, Eleanor, needed new shoes. I had an image of myself sitting in front of a hive-shaped laptop while reminders in the form of bees dive-bombed my head, buzzing, "Do me, do me," while I slapped them away. It was time for some relief. I sat down and wrote a 5-page to-do list. Writing the list was sort of fun, but then I had to face the prospect of doing tasks that I'd been avoiding, in some cases for years. For the sake of morale, I added several items that could be crossed off with 5 minutes of effort. Over the next several weeks, I doggedly tackled my list. I had my first skin cancer check. I got the windows clean. I got a backup system for my computer. I figured out a mystery cable bill. I took my shoes to be rehealed. As I grappled with some of the more difficult items on the to-do list, though, I faced a discouraging number of boomerang errands. Errands that I thought I was getting rid of, but then came right back to me. 18 months overdue, congratulating myself on crossing the task off the list, I went to the dentist to get my teeth cleaned, only to discover that I had decay under one filling. I had to return to the dentist the next week. Boomerang. After months of procrastination, I asked the building super to fix our bedroom wall light, but it turned out he couldn't do it. He gave me the number of an electrician. I called the electrician. He came. He took the light off the wall, but he couldn't fix it. He told me about a repair shop. I took the light to the repair shop. A week later, I picked it up. Then the electrician had to come back and install it. Then the light worked again. Boomerang, boomerang, boomerang. I had to accept the fact that some nagging tasks would never be crossed off my list. I would have to do them every day for the rest of my life. Finally, I started wearing sunscreen every day. Well, most days. Finally, I started flossing every day. Well, most days. Although I knew that sun exposure can lead to cancer and unhealthy gums can lead to tooth loss, focusing on wrinkles and bad breath proved to be more motivating considerations. Sometimes, though, the most difficult part of doing a task was just deciding to do it. I began one morning by sending an email that included only 48 words and took 45 seconds to write, yet it had been weighing on my mind for at least 2 weeks. Such unfinished tasks were disproportionately draining. An important aspect of happiness is managing your moods, and studies show that one of the best ways to lift your mood is to engineer an easy success, such as tackling a long-delayed chore. I was astounded by the dramatic boost in my mental energy that came from taking care of these neglected tasks. Act more energetic. To feel more energetic, I applied one of my 12 commandments. Act the way I want to feel. This commandment sums up one of the most helpful insights that I learned in my happiness research. Although we presume that we act because of the way we feel, in fact, we often feel because of the way we act. For example, studies show that even an artificially induced smile brings about happier emotions, and one experiment suggested that people who use Botox are less prone to anger because they can't make angry faces. The philosopher and psychologist William James explained, "Actions seem to follow feeling, but really action and feeling go together. And by regulating the action, which is under the more direct control of the will, we can indirectly regulate the feeling, which is not." Advice from every quarter, ancient and contemporary, backs up the observation that to change our feelings, we should change our actions. Although a fake it till you feel it strategy sounded hokey, I found it extremely effective. When I felt draggy, I started to act with more energy. I sped up my walk. I paced while talking on the phone. I put more warmth and zest into my voice. Sometimes I feel exhausted by the prospect of spending time with my own children. But one tired afternoon, instead of trying to devise a game that involved my lying on the couch, I've managed to be astonishingly resourceful in coming up with ideas. I bounded into the room and said, "Hey, let's play in the tent." It really worked. I did manage to give myself an energy boost by acting with energy. By the end of January, I was off to a promising start, but did I feel happier? It was too soon to tell. I did feel more alert and calm, and although I still had periods when I felt overtaxed, they became less frequent. I found that rewarding myself for good behavior, even when that reward was nothing more than a check mark that I gave to myself on my resolutions chart, made it easier for me to stick to a resolution. Getting a bit of reinforcement did make a difference. I could see, however, that I'd have to remind myself continually to keep my resolutions. In particular, I noticed a decline in my order-maintaining zeal by the end of the month. I loved the big payoff of cleaning out a closet, but keeping the apartment tidy was a Sisyphean task that was never finished. Perhaps the one-minute rule and the evening tidy-up would keep me attacking clutter regularly, in small doses, so that it couldn't grow to its previous crushing proportions. Nevertheless, I was astonished by the charge of energy and satisfaction I got from creating order. The closet that had been an eyesore was now a joy. The stack of papers slowly yellowing on the edge of my desk was gone. "It is by studying little things," wrote Samuel Johnson, "that we attain the great art of having as little misery and as much happiness as possible." Chapter 2, February. Remember love. Marriage. Quit nagging. Don't expect praise or appreciation. Fight right. No dumping. Give proofs of love. One alarming fact jumps out from the research about happiness in marriage. Marital satisfaction drops substantially after the first child arrives. The disruptive presence of new babies and teenagers, in particular, puts a lot of pressure on marriages, and discontent spikes when children are in these stages. Jamie and I had been married for 11 years, and sure enough, the incidence of low-level bickering in our marriage increased significantly after our daughter Eliza was born. Until then, the phrase, "Can't you do it?" had never crossed my lips. Over the last several years, I'd started doing too much complaining, nagging, and foot-dragging. It was time to do something about that. As corny as it sounds, I've always felt that from the moment we were introduced in the library during law school, when I was the first year and he was the second year, Jamie and I have had an extraordinary love. The rose-colored pile jacket he was wearing that afternoon still hangs at the back of my closet. In recent years, though, I'd begun to worry that an accumulation of minor irritations and sharp words were making us less outwardly loving. Our marriage wasn't in trouble. We showed our affection openly and often. We were indulgent with each other. We handled conflict pretty well. We didn't practice the behaviors that the marriage expert John Gottman calls the four horsemen of the apocalypse for their destructive role in relationships: stonewalling, defensiveness, criticism, and contempt. Well, sometimes we indulged in stonewalling, defensiveness, and criticism, but never contempt, the worst behavior of all. But I had fallen into some bad habits that I wanted to change. Working on my marriage was an obvious goal for my happiness project because a good marriage is one of the factors most strongly associated with happiness. Partly this reflects the fact that happy people find it easier to get and stay married than unhappy people do, because happy people make better dates and easier spouses. But marriage itself also brings happiness because it provides the support and companionship that everyone needs. For me, as for most married people, my marriage was the foundation of all the other important choices in my life. Where I lived, having kids, my friends, my work, my leisure. The atmosphere of my marriage set the weather for my whole life. That's why I decided not only to include marriage in my happiness project, but also to tackle it early, in the second month. Yet though my relationship with Jamie was the most important factor in shaping my daily existence, it was also, unfortunately, the relationship in which I was most likely to behave badly. Too often, I focused on gripes and disputes, and I did quite a lot of blaming. If the light bulbs were burned out, if I was feeling plagued by a messy apartment, or even if I felt discouraged about my work, I blamed Jamie. Jamie is a funny mix. He has a sardonic side that can make him seem distant and almost harsh to people who don't know him well, but he's also very tender-hearted. A good example, he loves movies that I find unbearably dark, such as Open Water and Reservoir Dogs, but he also loves sweet, sentimental movies. His favorite is Say Anything. He drives me crazy by refusing to carry out various husbandly assignments, then surprises me by upgrading my computer without my asking. He makes the bed, but never uses the clothes hamper. He's bad at buying presents for birthdays, but he brings home lovely gifts unexpectedly. Like everyone, he's a combination of good and not-so-good qualities, and the worst of my bad habits was to focus on his faults while taking his virtues for granted. I had come to understand one critical fact about my happiness project. I couldn't change anyone else. As tempting as it was to try, I couldn't lighten the atmosphere of our marriage by bullying Jamie into changing his ways. I could work only on myself. For inspiration, I turn to the 12th of my 12 commandments. There is only love. A friend of mine was the source of that commandment. She came up with the phrase when she was considering taking a high-pressure job where she'd be working for a notoriously difficult person. The person handling the hiring process told her, "I'm going to be honest with you. John Doe is very effective, but he's an extremely tough guy to work for. Think hard about whether you want this job." My friend really wanted the job, so she decided, there is only love. From that moment on, she refused to think critical thoughts about John Doe. She never complained about him behind his back. She wouldn't even listen to other people criticize him. "Don't your coworkers think you're a goody-goody?" I asked. "Oh, no," she said. "They all wish they could do the same thing, too. He drives them crazy, but I can honestly say that I like John." If my friend could do that for her boss, why couldn't I do it for Jamie? Deep down, I had only love for Jamie, but I was allowing too many petty issues to get in the way. I wasn't living up to my own standards of behavior, and then, because I felt guilty when I behaved badly, I behaved even worse. Love is a funny thing. I'd donate a kidney to Jamie without a moment's hesitation, but I was intensely annoyed if he asked me to make a special stop at the drugstore to pick up shaving cream. Studies show that the most common sources of conflict among couples are money, work, sex, communication, religion, children, in-laws, appreciation, and leisure activities. Having a newborn is also particularly tough. However, these categories, as seemingly all-inclusive as they were, didn't quite capture my problem areas. I thought hard about my particular marriage and the changes I could make to restore the tenderness and patience of our newlywed, pre-baby days. First, I needed to change my approach to household work. I was spending too much time handing out assignments and nagging, and not only was I nagging Jamie to do his work, I was nagging him to give me praise for my work. Also, I wanted to become more lighthearted, especially in moments of anger. A line by G.K. Chesterton echoed in my head. It is easy to be heavy, hard to be light. Or as the saying goes, dying is easy, comedy is hard. And I wanted to stop taking Jamie for granted. Small, frequent gestures of thoughtfulness were more important than flowers on Valentine's Day, and I wanted to load Jamie with small treats and courtesies, praise and appreciation. After all, as my secret of adulthood holds, what you do every day matters more than what you do once in a while. Jamie didn't ask me what experiments I'd planned for the month, and I didn't tell him. I knew him well enough to know that although he realized that, in some ways, he was my lab rat, hearing about the details would make him feel self-conscious. These resolutions were going to be tough for me. I knew that. I wasn't unrealistic enough to expect to be able to keep every resolution every day, but I wanted to aim higher than I had. One reason I started my happiness project by raising my energy and clearing my clutter was that I knew I'd be more able to act lighthearted and loving if I didn't feel overwhelmed by mental or physical disorder. It seemed ridiculous, but already, having a tidier closet and getting more sleep was putting me into a happier and more peaceable frame of mind. The challenge would be to keep up with January's resolutions now that I was adding a new list of resolutions for February. Quit nagging. Jamie hated being nagged, and I hated being a nag, yet I found myself doing it all too often. Studies show that the quality of a couple's friendship determines, in large part, whether they feel satisfied with their marriage's romance and passion, and nothing kills the feeling of friendship and passion more than nagging. Anyway, nagging doesn't work. Our Valentine's cards gave me a chance to put this resolution to a test. As happens to many people, about 5 minutes after Eliza was born, I was possessed with an irresistible urge to send out yearly holiday cards. In a decision born more out of desperation rather than originality, I decided to make a tradition of sending cards in February for Valentine's Day instead of in December when life is crazy. When it was time to send out the cards this year, as Jamie and I sat down to watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I got out the enormous stacks of envelopes and asked brightly, "Would you like to stuff or seal?" He gave me a sad look and said, "Please don't make me." I struggled to decide how to answer. Should I insist that he help? Should I tell him that it wasn't fair that I had to do all the work? That I'd done the hard part of ordering the cards and arranging for the photo, an adorable picture of Eleanor and Eliza in ballet clothes, and he was just helping with the easy part? On the other hand, I decided to do these cards to suit myself. Was it fair to ask him to help? Well, fairness didn't really matter. I'd rather finish the envelopes myself rather than feel like a nag. "It's okay," I told him with a sigh. "Don't worry about it." I did feel a few twinges of resentment when I glanced at Jamie lounging back on the sofa, but I realized that I enjoyed not feeling like a nag more than I enjoyed watching TV without licking envelopes at the same time. After the movie, Jamie looked over at me, where I sat surrounded by stuffed, sealed, and stamped red envelopes. He put his hand on mine. "Will you be my Valentine?" I was glad that I decided not to push it. To make it easier to quit nagging, I made myself a checklist of anti-nagging techniques. First, because it's annoying to hear a hectoring voice, I found ways for us to suggest tasks without talking. When I put an envelope on the floor by the front door, Jamie knew he was supposed to mail it on his way to work. I limited myself to a one-word reminder, instead of barking out, "Now remember, you promised to figure out what's wrong with the video camera before we go to the park." I just said, "Camera," as Jamie got up from lunch. I reminded myself that tasks didn't need to be done according to my schedule. I had to fight the urge to nag Jamie to retrieve the play slide from our basement storage, because once I decided Eleanor would enjoy it, I wanted it brought up immediately. But it wasn't really urgent. I did give myself credit for not indulging in the popular, "it's for your own good" variety of nagging. I never bugged Jamie about taking an umbrella, eating breakfast, or going to the dentist. Although some people think that that kind of nagging shows love, I think that an adult should be able to decide whether or not to wear a sweater without interference from others. The most obvious and least appealing anti-nagging technique, of course, was to do a task myself. Why did I get to decree that it was Jamie's responsibility to make sure we had plenty of cash on hand? Once I took over the job, we always had cash, and I was much happier. And when Jamie did a task, I didn't allow myself to carp from the sidelines. I thought he paid too much when he bought the replacement for the dud video camera, but it was his decision to make in his own way. I also tried to be more observant and appreciative of all the tasks that Jamie did. I was certainly guilty of unconscious overclaiming, the phenomenon in which we unconsciously overestimate our contributions or skills relative to other people. It's related to the Garrison Keillor named Lake Wobegon fallacy, which describes the fact that we all fancy ourselves to be above average. In one study, when students in a work group each estimated their contribution to the team, the total was 139%. This makes sense, because we're far more aware of what we do than what other people do. I complain about the time I spend paying bills, but I overlook the time Jamie spends dealing with our car. I have a friend who has a radical solution. She and her husband don't assign. Even though they have 4 children, they have a tacit agreement never to say things such as, "You need to take the kids to the birthday party," or "Fix the toilet, it's running again." Their system works because they both pitch in. But even so, I can't imagine living that way. It's an impossible ideal, yet inspiring. Don't expect praise or appreciation. My examination of my nagging habit showed me that I also engaged in a more subtle form of nagging, nagging that concerned work that I did. I nagged Jamie to give me more praise. With something like the Valentine's card project, I realized that what I really wanted, even more than help, was for Jamie to say something such as, "Wow, the photograph of the girls is terrific. You're doing a great job with these Valentine's cards." I wanted that gold star stuck on my homework. Why did I have such a need for gold stars? Was it vanity that needed to be stoked? Was it insecurity that needed to be soothed? Whatever the reason, I knew I should get over my need for Jamie to applaud the nice things I did, and even more, I should get over my need for Jamie even to notice the nice things I did. So I made the resolution, don't expect praise or appreciation. Until I started paying close attention, I hadn't appreciated how much this need affected my behavior. One morning, I staggered into the kitchen in my robe around 7:30 a.m. I'd been up for much of the night with Eleanor, who had hardly slept. Jamie had got up with her around 6, so I could go back to bed. "Good morning," I mumbled as I cracked open a Diet Coke. I didn't add any words of thanks for my luxurious extra 90 minutes of sleep. Jamie waited a moment, then prompted, "I hope you appreciate that I bought you some time this morning." He needs gold stars himself, even though he isn't very good, to my mind, at handing them out. I'd been concentrating about behaving better in my marriage. I'd been patting myself on the back for learning so much. So did I say in a tender voice, "Of course I appreciate it. Thanks so much. You're my hero." Did I give Jamie a big hug of gratitude? Nope. Because Jamie neglected to give me a gold star for staying up with Eleanor, I snapped, "I did appreciate it, but you never show any appreciation when I let you sleep. Then you expect a lot of gratitude when you let me sleep." Jamie's look made me wish I'd reacted differently. I remembered my 9th commandment, lighten up. I put my arms around him. "I'm sorry, really. I shouldn't have talked that way, and I do appreciate getting the extra sleep this morning." "You know," he said, "I was really trying to give you a treat, and I do appreciate the fact that you let me sleep." "Okay." We hugged, for at least 6 seconds, which, I happen to know from my research, is the minimum time necessary to promote the flow of oxytocin and serotonin, mood-boosting chemicals that promote bonding. The moment of tension passed. This exchange led me to an important insight into how to manage myself better. I'd been self-righteously telling myself that I did certain chores or made certain efforts for Jamie or for the team. Though this sounded generous, it led to a bad result because I sulked when Jamie didn't appreciate my efforts. Instead, I started to tell myself, I'm doing this for myself. This is what I want. I wanted to send out Valentine's cards. I wanted to clean out the kitchen cabinets. This sounded selfish, but in fact it was less selfish because it meant I wasn't nagging to get a gold star from Jamie or anyone else. No one else even had to notice what I'd done. I remember talking to a friend whose parents had been very involved in the civil rights movement. They always said, he told me, that you have to do that kind of work for yourself. If you do it for other people, you end up wanting them to acknowledge it and to be grateful and to give you credit. If you do it for yourself, you don't expect other people to react in a particular way. I think that's right. Nevertheless, for all my talk of giving up gold stars, I have to admit that I still thought it would be nice for Jamie to hand them out a bit more lavishly. Whether or not I should want them, I do. Fight right. Nagging was easier to address than some other behaviors I was trying to change. I faced a tougher challenge with my second priority, lightening my attitude. Marital conflicts fall into two categories, issues that can be clearly resolved and those that can't. Unfortunately, more conflicts fall into the open-ended, how should we spend our money and how should we raise our children categories than into the easier, what movie should we see this weekend or where should we go on our vacation this summer category. Some disagreement is inevitable and even valuable. Since Jamie and I were going to fight, I wanted to be able to have fights that were more fun, where we could joke around and be affectionate, even while we were disagreeing. I also wanted to conquer my own particular bosom enemy, snapping. Far too often, in a kind of one-sided mini-fight, I would lash out in sudden fits of temper that soured the household mood. I'd often wondered why anger, along with pride, greed, gluttony, lust, sloth, and envy, were the seven deadly sins, because they didn't seem as deadly as a lot of other sins. It turns out they're deadly sins not because of their gravity, but because of their power to generate other worse sins. They're the gateway sins to the big sins. Of the seven deadly sins, anger was certainly my nemesis. Fighting style is very important to the health of a marriage. Gottman's Love Laboratory research shows that how a couple fights matters more than how much they fight. Couples who fight right tackle only one difficult topic at a time instead of indulging in arguments that cover every grievance since the first date. These couples ease into arguments instead of blowing up immediately and avoid bombs such as "you never" and "you always." They know how to bring an argument to an end instead of keeping it going for hours. They make repair attempts by using words or actions to keep bad feelings from escalating. They recognize other pressures imposed on a spouse. A husband acknowledges that his wife feels overwhelmed by the demands of work and home. A wife acknowledges that her husband feels caught between her and his mother. Here's an example of how not to fight right. Apparently, much as I hate to acknowledge it, I may snore from time to time. I hate to hear any mention of it because snoring sounds so unattractive. But when Jamie joked about it one morning, I was trying to be light, so I laughed along with him. Then a few weeks later, as we were listening to our favorite all-news radio station before the 6:30 alarm rang, and I was reflecting groggily on how much more peaceful our bedroom was now that I'd cleared away so much mess, Jamie said in a sweet, kidding-around way, "I'll start the day with two observations. First, you snore." I snapped. "So that's the first thing I have to hear in the morning?" I exploded. I practically threw the covers in his face as I got out of bed. "That I snore? Can you think of nothing nicer to say?" I stormed across the room and started yanking clothes out of the closet. "If you want me to stop, give me a poke while I'm sleeping, but don't keep harping on it." Lesson learned? By laughing along with him, I'd made Jamie think that snoring was a good subject for a joke. I tried to be light, but I couldn't. I wish I could always laugh at myself easily, but in some situations I can't, and I should have responded honestly so I could avoid an eventual blow-up. Jamie had had no warning that his comment was going to enrage me. So much for fight right. This time, I hadn't managed to keep my resolution. I couldn't even bring myself to apologize. I just wanted to forget about it. But next time, I'd do better, I hoped. In marriage, it's less important to have many pleasant experiences than it is to have fewer unpleasant experiences, because people have a negativity bias. Our reactions to bad events are faster, stronger, and stickier than our reactions to good events. In fact, in practically every language, there are more concepts to describe negative emotions than positive emotions. It takes at least 5 positive marital actions to offset 1 critical or destructive action. So one way to strengthen a marriage is to make sure that the positive far outweighs the negative. When a couple's interactions are usually loving and kind, it's much easier to disregard the occasional unpleasant exchange. I had a feeling, however, that it would take more than 5 marital actions on both our parts to offset the negative force of our snoring exchange. Fighting right made a big difference to my happiness because the failure to fight right was a significant source of guilt in my life. As Mark Twain observed, an uneasy conscience is a hair in the mouth. When Jamie did something annoying and I snapped at him, and then I felt bad about snapping, I blamed it on him. But in fact, I realized, a major cause of my bad feelings wasn't Jamie's behavior, but rather my guilt about my reaction to his behavior. Fighting right eliminated that guilt and so made me happier. One day when I repeatedly failed to fight right helped me to see this point clearly. For President's Day weekend, we went on a little vacation with Jamie's parents. My in-laws, Judy and Bob, are wonderful grandparents with whom to vacation. Helpful, easygoing, with a reasonable tolerance for chaos. But they like to have plenty of time when traveling, and in our rush to get out the door to meet them, I let myself get too hungry. Just as we were leaving the apartment, I realized I was famished, and I gave myself a quick fix by digging into an enormous heart-shaped box of M&Ms that Eliza had gotten for Valentine's Day. Eating all that candy made me feel guilty and a little sick, and I couldn't keep from making nasty remarks. The worse I behaved, the guiltier I felt, and that made me behave worse. Jamie, please get those papers out of my way. Eliza, stop leaning on me. You're hurting my arm. Jamie, can't you get that bag? Even after we arrived at the hotel, having made a wrong start, I couldn't shake my bad feelings. Are you okay? Jamie asked me at one point. Sure, I'm fine, I mumbled, temporarily chastened, but my bad mood soon reasserted itself. That night, after Eliza and Eleanor went to sleep, the adults could finally have a sustained conversation. We drank our after-dinner coffee. Even after years as part of this family, I still marvel at Judy's and Bob's ability to drink espresso with caffeine after dinner, and talked about a recent New York Times article about VX-950, a hepatitis C drug in trials. We cared a lot about those trials. Jamie jokes about being a broken toy with his bad knee, his impressive scar from childhood surgery, and occasional back spasms. But his major broken part is his liver. He has hepatitis C. As chronic and potentially fatal conditions go, hepatitis C has some good points. It's not contagious except through direct blood contact. Jamie has no apparent symptoms and found out that he has hepatitis C only through a blood test. One day he'll develop cirrhosis and his liver will stop functioning and he'll be in very big trouble. But for now, he's perfectly fine. Also, when it comes to health problems, misery loves company. If a lot of people share your ailment, drug companies work hard to find a cure. About 3 million people in the United States have hepatitis C, along with 170 million or so worldwide, so it's an active area of research, and Jamie's doctors estimate that new effective treatments are likely to be approved within 5 to 8 years. Hepatitis C has a very long course. Of the people who develop cirrhosis, most don't get it for 20 or 30 years. 30 years sounds like a very long time, but Jamie picked up hepatitis C through a blood transfusion during a heart operation when he was 8 years old, before screening for hepatitis C began. And now he's 38. The one treatment now available, pegylated interferon plus ribavirin, didn't work for Jamie, despite an unpleasant year of flu-like symptoms, pills, and weekly shots. Now we just have to hope that Jamie manages to hang on to his liver until researchers find new treatments. In addition to cirrhosis leading to liver failure, itself not an attractive prospect. Hepatitis C also makes liver cancer far more likely. Thank goodness for liver transplants, though a transplanted liver is no picnic, and scarily not always possible to get. Like the old joke about the restaurant, the food is terrible, yes, and the portions are so small. So we were all very interested in the Times piece's description of possible new treatments. My father-in-law, Bob, found the article encouraging, but every time he made a comment, I countered it. According to the article, the research is very promising, he said. But both of Jamie's liver doctors told us that it's going to be at least 5 years, if not more, for a drug to be approved, I answered. The article suggests that they're making great strides, he answered mildly. Bob never becomes argumentative. But there's still a very long way from getting it on the market. I often become argumentative. This field of research is enormously active, but the time horizon is very long, etc., etc., etc. It's not often that I find myself telling Bob that he's being overly optimistic. He emphasizes the importance of rational, probabilistic decision-making, and he practices this discipline himself, with yellow notepads with pros and cons columns, a habit of gathering multiple viewpoints, a detached markets go up, markets go down outlook. In this situation, however, he chose to take an optimistic view of the evidence. Why argue with him? I didn't agree with his view, but I'm no doctor. What did I know? My new aspirations for my behavior were high, but not unreasonable. I knew that my combativeness and pedantry in this conversation came not from petty irritation, but from a desire to protect myself against false hopes. Bob was taking the positive route, and I would have felt better if I'd let the issue go without arguing. I'm sure I made Bob, and certainly Jamie, feel worse by saying discouraging things, and being quarrelsome just made me feel bad. Fight right, not just with your husband, but with everyone. On a less lofty note, I also learned not to eat half a pound of M&Ms on an empty stomach. No dumping. For my research on learning how to fight right, I had acquired an extensive library of books on marriage and relationships. Anyone who looks at our shelves is going to think that our marriage is in trouble, Jamie observed. Why is that? I asked, startled. Look what you've got here. The 7 principles for making marriage work. Love is never enough. Baby-proofing your marriage. Uncoupling. One man hurt. I'd be worried myself if I didn't know what you were working on. But this material is great, I said. There's so much fascinating research. Sure, but people don't bother to read these books unless they have issues. Maybe Jamie was right, but I was happy that I'd had a reason to study the latest findings about marriage and relationships. I'd learned a lot. For example, there's an intriguing difference in how men and women approach intimacy. Although men and women agree that sharing activities and self-disclosure are important, women's idea of an intimate moment is a face-to-face conversation, while men feel close while they work or play sitting alongside someone. So when Jamie asked, "Do you want to watch The Shield?" I understood that in his eyes, watching TV together counted as true quality time, not "we're just sitting in a room watching TV, not talking to each other" time. "Great idea," I answered. And as it turned out, while lying in bed watching a TV show about a rogue cop in L.A. didn't sound very romantic, it felt romantic once we were cozily settled in against the pillows. Perhaps because men have this low standard for what qualifies as intimacy, both men and women find relationships with women to be more intimate and enjoyable than those with men. Women have more feelings of empathy for other people than men do, though women and men have about the same degree of empathy for animals, whatever that means. In fact, for both men and women, and this finding struck me as highly significant, the most reliable predictor of not being lonely is the amount of contact with women. Time spent with men doesn't make a difference. Learning about this research made a difference in my attitude toward Jamie. I love him with all my heart, and I know he loves me, and I know that I can absolutely trust and confide in him, yet I often felt frustrated because he never wanted to have long heart-to-heart discussions. In particular, I wish that he would take more interest in my work. My sister Elizabeth is a TV writer, and I envy her having her writing partner Sarah. Practically daily, she and Sarah have marathon conversations about their writing and career strategies. I don't have a partner or any colleagues with whom to discuss work issues, so I wanted Jamie to fill that role for me. Also, I expected to be able to dump all my insecurities into Jamie's lap. I'd start conversations with enticing openers such as, I'm worried that I'm not living up to my potential, or I'm doing a bad job of networking, or what if my writing is no good? Jamie, remarkably, didn't want to have these conversations, and that made me angry. I wanted him to help me work through my feelings of anxiety and self-doubt. Learning that men and women both turn to women for understanding showed me that Jamie wasn't ignoring me out of lack of interest or affection. He just wasn't good at giving that kind of support. Jamie wasn't going to have a long discussion about whether I should start a blog or how I should structure my book. He didn't want to spend hours pumping up my self-confidence. He was never going to play the role of a female writing partner, and it wasn't realistic to expect him to do it. If I needed that kind of support, I should figure out another way to get it. My realization didn't change his behavior, but I stopped feeling so resentful. I'd also noticed that the more upset I felt, the less Jamie seemed to want to talk about it. You know, I said to him one night, I'm feeling anxious. I wish you'd try to help me feel better. The worse I feel, the less you seem to want to talk to me. I just can't stand to see you unhappy, he answered. Light again dawned. It wasn't perversity that kept Jamie from being a sympathetic listener. Not only was he constitutionally less oriented to having long heart-to-heart conversations, he also tried to avoid any topic that got me upset because he found it so painful to see me feeling blue. Now, that didn't let him off the hook altogether. Sometimes I needed a sympathetic listener, even if he didn't feel like playing that role, but at least I understood his perspective. Our conversation started me thinking about how my happiness affected Jamie and others. I'd heard the aphorism, happy wife, happy life, or put another way, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. At first I thought that sounded great. Yippee, it's all about pleasing me. But if these sayings are true, it's a tremendous responsibility. I'd wondered whether my happiness project was selfish, because it seemed self-indulgent to concentrate on my own happiness. True, I do make other people happy when I tend to my own happiness. I was trying not to snap at Jamie and to laugh at his jokes. But it went beyond that. By being happy myself, I was better able to try to make other people happier. Happy people are generally more forgiving, helpful, and charitable, have better self-control, and are more tolerant of frustration than unhappy people. While unhappy people are more often withdrawn, defensive, antagonistic, and self-absorbed. Oscar Wilde observed, one is not always happy when one is good, but one is always good when one is happy. Happiness has a particularly strong influence in marriage because spouses pick up each other's moods so easily. A 30% increase in one spouse's happiness boosts the other spouse's happiness, while a drop in one spouse's happiness drags the other down. Not only that, I was fascinated to learn that in a phenomenon known as health concordance, partners' health behaviors tend to merge as they pick up good or bad habits from each other related to eating, exercising, visiting doctors, smoking, and drinking. I know that Jamie wants me to be happy. In fact, the happier I seem to be, the more Jamie tries to make me happy. And when I'm unhappy, for whatever reason, Jamie goes into a funk. So as part of my attempt to be happy, I resolved no dumping. Especially on Jamie. I would bring up my worries if I really needed Jamie's counsel or support, but I wouldn't dump my minor troubles on him. I had an opportunity to live up to my resolution one Sunday morning. It was a rare moment of calm. Jamie was cleaning up the mess he'd created while whipping up pancakes. Eliza was absorbed in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Eleanor was covering every page of a Scooby-Doo coloring book with green crayon, and I was going through the mail. I opened an innocent-looking letter from our credit card company to discover that because of a security breach on its end, our main credit card had been canceled and we'd been issued a new card and number. I was furious. Now I'd have to go into every account that relied on that credit card number to update it. I hadn't kept a list, so I had no idea how I was going to figure out which accounts needed to be changed. Our automatic toll pass, our Amazon account, my gym membership, what else? The statement was so matter-of-fact, too. No apology, no little perk to acknowledge the corporate fault or the inconvenience to cardholders. This was the kind of chore that made me crazy. It took up precious time and mental energy, Yet when it was done, I was no better off than I was before I started it. I can't believe this, I fumed to Jamie. They've canceled our credit card because of their mistake. I was prepared to launch into a full diatribe when the thought flashed through my mind. No dumping. I paused. Why should I spoil a peaceful moment with my irritation? Hearing someone complain is tiresome, whether you're in a good mood or a bad one, and whether or not the complaining is justified. I took a deep breath and stopped in mid-rant. Oh well, was all I said in a tone of forced calm. Jamie looked at me with surprise, then relief. He probably knew what an effort it had taken for me to restrain myself. When I got up to get more coffee, he stood up to give me a hug without saying anything. Give proofs of love. I've never forgotten something I read in college by Pierre Reverdy. There is no love, there are only proofs of love. Whatever love I might feel in my heart, others will see only my actions. When I looked back at my resolutions chart, I could see that some entries, such as toss, restore, organize, boasted a row of cheerful check marks, while other resolutions were dotted with X marks. I was doing a lot better with go to sleep earlier than with don't expect praise or appreciation. Fortunately, give proofs of love seemed like the kind of action that could easily become a pleasant habit. Some ways of showing my love were easy. Because people are 47%, how did they come up with these statistics, more apt to feel close to a family member who often expresses affection than to one who rarely does, I started telling Jamie, I love you, at every turn and putting I-L-Y at the end of my emails. I also started hugging Jamie more, as well as other people in my life. Hugging relieves stress, boosts feelings of closeness, and even squelches pain. In one study, people assigned to give 5 hugs each day for a month, aiming to hug as many different people as they could, became happier. Some things I was already doing right, because I didn't want every one of my emails to Jamie to contain some irksome question or reminder. I'd gotten into the habit of sending him enjoyable messages with interesting news or funny stories about the girls. One day, when I walked by Jamie's office building in Midtown on my way to a meeting, I stopped to call him on my cell phone. Are you at your desk? I asked. Yes, why? Look down at the steps of St. Bartholomew's. The church was right across the street from Jamie's office. Do you see me waving to you? Yes, look, there you are. I'm waving back. Taking the time to give that silly, affectionate wave filled me with good feelings that lasted for hours. These were small gestures, but they made a surprisingly big shift in the tone of our interactions. I had an opportunity to make a larger gesture, too, because my mother-in-law, Judy, had a significant birthday coming up. Parents and in-laws play a big part in our lives. My parents, Karen and Jack Kraft, live in Kansas City, where I grew up, but one or both of my parents visit every few months, and we go to Kansas City to stay with them at least twice a year. These visits are of the intense, what should we all do today, variety. Jamie's parents live just around the corner. Literally, there's one lone, skinny townhouse between their apartment building and our apartment building. When we're walking around the neighborhood, we often see them heading toward us on their way to get coffee or to stop by the market. Judy with her silver hair and beautiful scarves, Bob with his stiff gait and wool cap. Fortunately for our marriage, Jamie and I agree on the importance of our relationships with our two sets of parents, so it was natural for me to be thinking about Judy's birthday. If we'd asked Judy how she'd like to celebrate, she would have said she didn't care. However, if you want to know how people would like to be treated, it's more helpful to look at how they themselves act than what they say. Judy is one of the most reliable people I've ever met. She never forgets an obligation, fails to do something she says she'll do, or misses an important date. And though she insists that exchanging birthday or holiday gifts isn't important to her, no one gives more thoughtful and beautifully wrapped presents. She even gives us wedding anniversary presents that track the traditional theme for each year. For our 4th fruits and flowers anniversary, she gave us a beautiful quilt with a fruits and flowers design. For our 10th tin aluminum anniversary, she gave us 10 boxes of aluminum foil. Jamie, his father, and his brother Phil aren't good at planning birthday celebrations. In the past, I would have made a few reminder comments as Judy's birthday loomed, nagged at Jamie to make plans, then had a smug, I told you so attitude when the birthday wasn't celebrated properly. My happiness project work hadn't all been in vain, however, and I saw the solution to the problem. I would take charge. I knew the kind of party Judy would like. She definitely wouldn't want a surprise party, and she'd prefer a family party at home. She valued thoughtfulness far more than lavishness, so homemade gifts that showed forethought would mean more to her than anything store-bought, and she'd like a home-cooked meal more than dinner in a fancy restaurant. Fortunately, my brother-in-law Phil and his wife Lauren are gifted chefs who run a catering company, so a meal could be both home-cooked and fancy. A vision came to me as if in a dream, then I needed authority to execute it. I called my father-in-law at the office. "Hi, Bob, I'm calling to talk about plans for Judy's birthday." "That's a little far off, don't you think?" "Not really, not if we want to plan something special, and I think we should." Pause. "Well," he said slowly, "I'd been thinking, because I have an idea, if you'd like to hear what I think might be fun." "Oh, yes," he said with relief. "What do you have in mind?" Bob immediately signed on to my plan. He's a very good sport about dealing with many kinds of tiresome family tasks and obligations, but this kind of project didn't play to his strengths. In fact, everyone in the family cooperated happily. They wanted Judy to have a wonderful birthday, too. They just weren't inclined to do the kind of planning it would require. In pursuit of my vision, I took complete control. A few days before the party, I sent around an email to Jamie, Bob, Phil, and Lauren, and to their credit, I didn't get a single snarky email in response. "Hello, all. Judy's birthday is just 4 days away. We want a pile of wrapped presents. This means you. One is not enough. Bob, Eliza and I wrapped your present. Are you bringing champagne? Jamie, have you bought the present from you and me? Phil and Lauren, what are you making for dinner? Is there anything special I need to have on hand? What time do you need to arrive? White wine or red wine with the food? Did you say you were making menu cards? I think Judy would think that was hilarious. Everyone, I know I'd open myself up for family scorn if I instructed everyone that it was inappropriate to wear your 'I just rolled off the couch to amble over to your party' clothes. So I won't say a word about that. Just remember that it is the sense of occasion and thoughtfulness that will make it a great night. This will be fun! XXG. I did a lot of preparation for this party. Eliza and I went to the Our Name is Mud pottery store, where Eliza decorated dinner plates with theater themes, reflecting her grandmother's passion. We spent a pleasant hour, yes, hour, scrolling through the Colette's Cakes website to choose the prettiest cake. Jamie and I shot a DVD of Eliza singing a selection of Judy's favorite songs, with Eleanor toddling through the action. On the night of the party, before everyone was due to arrive at 6:30 p.m., I began my anxious last-minute tidying. My mother loves to entertain, and from her, I inherited a propensity to pre-party jitters, which we call hostess neurosis. Experienced family members know to drift out of sight, lest they be conscripted into sudden vacuuming. But when Jamie emerged from hiding at 6:29 p.m., he was wearing khakis, a plaid shirt, and no shoes. I took a moment, then, careful to use a light tone, I remarked, "I wish you were wearing something a little nicer." Jamie looked as if he took a moment, then answered, "I'll put on a nicer pair of pants. Is that okay?" Then he went up and changed his pants and his shirt and put on shoes, too. The evening unfolded exactly as I'd hoped. Before the adults sat down for dinner, the granddaughters ate chicken salad sandwiches, Judy's favorite, with their grandmother. We presented the birthday cake while the girls were still awake so they could sing happy birthday and eat a piece. Then we packed the girls off to bed and the adults sat down to eat. Indian food, Judy's favorite. "This was really a perfect evening," Judy said as everyone stood up to go. "I loved everything about it. My presents, the food, the cake, really, everything was wonderful." It was obvious that Judy really did enjoy the party, and everyone was pleased to have played a part. But I think I enjoyed it most of all. I was so happy that it turned out just right. The party underscored the truth of the third of my 12 commandments: act the way I want to feel. Although I might have predicted that organizing the party would make me feel resentful, in fact, acting in a loving way amplified my loving feelings toward everyone in the family, particularly Judy. I must admit, however, that at times before the party, I felt that Jamie and the others weren't appreciative enough. I was happy to do the planning, and I would have been annoyed if anyone else had tried to take over, but I still wanted my gold star. I wanted Jamie, Bob, or Phil to say, "Wow, Gretchen, you're really putting together a terrific evening. Thanks so much for your brilliant, creative, and thoughtful planning." That wasn't going to happen, so let it go. Do it for myself. But Jamie knows me very well. While Judy was opening her gifts, Jamie pulled a box from a shelf and handed it to me. "This is for you," he said. "For me?"